Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. We've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to be talking about censorship and compromise of free speech with Carolyn Betts and Sean Buckley. Sean is the marvelous attorney who involved us, and then we've done several shows with him on Financial Rebellion on the National Commission that they've done in Canada. If you haven't heard this, it's remarkable. And he hails. Are you in Alberta right now?
I'm in Alberta, which, you know, in theory, we're the most free, I'll say state, we call them provinces in Canada.
Right.
Except that we arrest more pastors than anyone else when they dare to hold church. So
you're in what I would describe as the live free and die section of Canada. It's
the Texas of Canada.
Yeah, it's the Texas of Canada. Perfect. Okay, so what we wanted to do today, there have been dramatic developments in efforts to compromise free speech, both in the United States and Canada. And I was struck, Sean, Carolyn and I received a Substack description of sort of the latest things going on in Canada. And I said, whoa, we have to get Sean on the Soleri Report. So tell us, bring us up to date. What are the latest developments in Canada? For somebody who's done more to bring free speech to Canada, you know, than just about anybody, you and your team have done incredible things to bring free speech. So I would like to point out before we start, somebody is making free speech happen, whether the powers that be want it or not. So tell us what the latest developments are.
Yeah, you know, as long as we can, and with all the shadow banning and everything else going on. So as bad as it already wasn't or is in Canada, on February 26th, our federal government introduced a new bill called Bill C-63, which is going to take things to a whole new level, because now we can be liable for what we might do in the future. So our criminal code is actually being amended. So they're putting in a section that regardless of any crime you commit, if it's motivated by hatred, now there's a separate crime with a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. So, you know, let's say you're, you know, an 18-year-old punk and you, you know, spray paint something hateful on a wall and you're charged with mischief and, you know, basically given 3 months probation with some community service. Well, now you've got this other charge, and courts always look at, well, what's the maximum penalty and where does this fit in? So when the maximum penalty is life imprisonment, you know, you're not getting 3 months probation now. But the even scarier part is now without you even being charged, without you actually doing anything, anyone can lay, we call it an information, saying that, well, I'm afraid that this person is in the future going to commit a hate crime or any crime motivated by hatred. And so you're not charged. It's not a criminal charge. But the court basically, as a preventative measure, can put you under conditions for up to 2 years, including wearing an ankle bracelet for electronic monitoring. They can put you under a curfew. So basically, you can be under house arrest. They can force you to give bodily substances and put you under a condition that you not drink and not do drugs. They can basically say you can't go to certain places and you can't have contact with somebody. And if the court puts you under this, it's called a recognizance. So if a court decides, oh yeah, you know, there is, and the test is the person just has, they just basically believe, like, so the person has reasonable grounds to believe. You can be put under this recognizance. If you refuse, the judge can put you into jail for a year.
Who gets to decide that? Because I'm still not clear what the test is. Who gets to decide that you might say something hateful in the future?
Well, and this is the worry, is that actually, because there's already history of actually groups. So, you know, you could have George Soros funding groups that actually are looking to make complaints against, you know, freedom leaders or other influencers, saying, I'm afraid, like, so now, you know, everything people like you say, Catherine, so let's say you're a Canadian and you're in, well, you don't have to be Canadian, so let's just say you're touring Canada And there's people watching every word you say. And if some of it can be construed as hate speech or in any way twisted to suggest that you might commit any crime in the future motivated by hatred, now all of a sudden you could find yourself in court proceedings where, you know, a court is being asked to put you under conditions to prevent you from doing what you might do but haven't done.
So long as speeding is not a hate crime, I think I'm okay.
Yeah. You know, unless you're speeding through an ethnic neighborhood, I don't know. Like, it's crazy, isn't it? Now, and it's not just criminal offenses. It's any offense under any federal criminal law power, which is, you know, quite broad. Like, so even, you know, our food and drug laws are, it's criminal law power. Like, so it's kind of interesting. And then also they've added into the Human Rights Act to basically make any speech deemed hateful to now be a separate complaint ground under our human rights legislation. Uh-huh. And, you know, this is just a balance of probabilities thing because it's not considered, you know, a charge. It's under our human rights legislation.
Does hate have to be hate of a person, or can it be a, you know, if I say I hate tapioca or I hate Brussels?
Yeah, no, it has to be a person or identifiable group. And in fact, I could give you, if you give me a second, the definition, if I can just pull to work.
Is this something that that has to possibly result in violence or something other than hurting someone's feelings?
Well, let me just read the definition they're putting into the human rights legislation. So in this section, hate speech means the content of a communication that expresses detestation or vilification of an individual or group of individuals on the basis of a prohibited ground of discrimination. So, you know, age, sex, race, sexual orientation, things like that. Like, so the grounds of, so it's really just expresses vilification, or, you know, that you detest somebody is now hate speech. I mean, that's really vague, isn't it?
But if you, for example, criticize a Catholic encyclical, is that possibly hate speech?
I don't think that is, depending on how you do it. Now, you should know there's a separate bill before Parliament. Like in our criminal hate speech section of the criminal code, there is an exemption for opinions that are based on religious belief. So, you know, the obvious one that Christians are going to run into trouble for soon is, you know, their stance on homosexuality. And like, regardless of where, you know, anyone in your audience stands on that, you know, the Bible is pretty clear on that. You're not supposed to do that. So
some people's Bible.
Anyway, the original one. But anyway, so there's an act before Parliament to take that exception out of the criminal code, so that if you're expressing an opinion based on a religious belief, that you wouldn't be protected from hate speech. And we know it's just a matter of time before it's going to be illegal to express some religious beliefs in Canada. So, but that's the whole object of all of this, is to...
Is there any indication that this was possibly aimed at not criticizing political positions vis-a-vis Israel?
Not that, but what I see it is it's the main part about this isn't the offenses. The main part about this is that it's going to basically get the social media providers to basically police content to prevent political organization in the future. And this isn't coming out, and it's rather subtle. You get it from the definitions. So, for example, in our definition of, you know, inciting hatred, if your communications are going to encourage people to an action that the action could cause property, like actually ends up causing property damage, And it could, the words really, it's literally could. So it could lead to an action that could lead, it's two coulds. So it could lead to an action that could cause, you know, bodily harm to somebody, or, you know, interruption with an essential service, and a road would be an essential service. Then the internet providers have an obligation to censor that and stop it. So I thought of the truckers' convoy. You know, the truckers were, you know, encouraging people on social media to attend, and other people were encouraging, you know, others to attend in Ottawa for this protest. Now, they're not asking anyone to commit property damage, but, you know, bouncy castles on Parliament Hill damage the lawn. You know, if a truck backs into a, you know, a sign parking, that's incidental property damage. Well, we know that organizing a large protest in Ottawa could lead to bodily harm, because we have the example of the police putting boots to people when they drag them out of the lines. And we at National Citizens Inquiry, we entered a video of a disabled veteran being pulled off of, you know, the Freedom Monument, and the police putting the boots to him when he was on the ground. We've got video of, you know, the horse trampling that disabled lady. So now you can easily anticipate that organizing a large protest in Ottawa could lead to bodily harm or interruption with the road system. So now social media platforms have an obligation to censor that type of organization going forward. So how do we organize peaceful protests? And it's co-opting the private sector once again to be the police state. I mean, when we talk about all these vaccine mandates and passports, which I call identity papers, it was the private sector that enforced it. It's we are the police state. That's the scary thing about this, is we're all going to find ourselves in a cage unless individually we stop complying with the police state.
Right. And that's the thing. You want everybody to just say, you know, we're just not participating. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. You can't put everybody in jail. And it's interesting. Carolyn and I were just talking about a presentation on civil disobedience, which the professor who had done the research felt that once 3.5% of the population engages in committed civil disobedience, things really change. So all you need is, and I think it's probably a little bit more, 3.5 to 5% saying, this is ridiculous. I refuse to take this seriously.
Maybe the drafters of this bill knew that and wanted to stop civil disobedience.
Oh, it's clearly this. I mean, it's meant to intimidate. But to me, the most scary part is that it turns the social media platforms. They have to have safety plans and operational plans and submit that to the new Ministry of Truth. That's not what it's called. That's just what I call it. And like, it's creating these government departments that the social media companies are now by law obligated to report to and basically provide all the content that the government wants. So basically our privacy is gone. Now, the act only permits access to this private information for the purposes of research, which itself is scaring me. I mean, so our privacy is now gone, because social media, I mean, that's a lot of our most intimate communications occur on social media platforms. And it's all being billed as this is to, you know, help protect children from, you know, sexual predators and sexual exploitation. But that's just a small little part. It's funny how they always couch it in, you know, in something that, oh, well, I can't oppose that. But Catherine, back to your 3.5%. You know, I'm haunted by one of the witnesses at the National Citizens Inquiry, Regina. And I don't know if I've spoken to her about her before, but she was a political refugee from Poland. And she was in the solidarity movement from the beginning. And she actually ended up getting arrested for, of all things, handing out brochures that went against the government narrative. And she was sentenced to 3.5 years of prison by a military tribunal, served 2 years, was released, and came to Canada as a political refugee. But she said, you know, everyone in Poland supported what we were trying to do. I mean, they were trying to peacefully, through general strikes, stop the police state. But it wasn't until the bread ran out that people took to the streets. So like everyone supports them, but they won't take action until the economy's crippled and now they're hungry because the bread's ran out. And now everyone's on the streets and they peacefully overturned a police state that had been there for over 40 years. And they could have peacefully overturned it at any time.
That's the magic. That's the magic information. They could have overturned it at any time.
Yeah. And I mean, I as a Canadian, because the United States is the most important country in the world. If you guys become a police state, it's done for the rest of us. And, you know, it's frustrating. Why aren't you guys just stopping it? You know the world's upside down. You know it's going the wrong direction. You have the best constitution in the world. Why aren't you standing up? Because the rest of the world looks to you.
So, Sean, this is a question that Carolyn and I have asked every day since 1995. You know, we just couldn't believe anybody was going along. Why would you go along with this? We can't go along with this. It's, you know, if we go along with this, it's just going to get worse. So you know, we've been saying you have to nip it in the bud since 1995. So,
Sean, you and I are both attorneys. And so the question arises, well, are the judges going to take care of this? And at least in our country, we have the First Amendment and laws can be declared unconstitutional. But we also know that the law, what Mary Holland is fond of saying, is that the law follows the culture. Mm-hmm. So if the culture tells the law, the lawyers, the judges, that the society isn't going to put up with it, it affects what the rulings are going to be. So that's a real question. But that brings us to the Murthy v. Missouri case, which we all know is Missouri v. Biden. And let me just explain that when the loser appeals, when the defendant appeals, the order of the parties flips. And Murthy is Vivek Murthy, who is the Surgeon General of the United States, who I think it's really wonderful that it's the Surgeon General's name is on this, because, you know, I sort of think that he had a lot to do with all of the propaganda about the COVID-19 shots. But that case has gone to the Supreme Court and will be argued on Monday. And there will be a rally at the Supreme Court organized by the Children's Health Defense. So anybody who's in Washington or driving distance, or even who wants to drive all night to get there, it's actually at the Supreme Court building on Monday.
Well, you know, you said something that I think is the key and that your viewers need to chime in, because the thing is it is about culture. Like, and in Canada, the courts, we had the largest intrusion by government ever. Like, even in wartime, it wasn't this bad. And there's not a single court decision I can point to that puts a brake on any level of government going forward, you know, if there's some other fake pandemic called, doing this. And the reason is the judges, they were afraid. And I mean, people were not, they were expecting the courts to uphold all of this, because literally in Canada, it was a military grade psyops. So how do you defeat the information war? Because we're talking about legislation on censorship, and it's already coming. Like various states in the United States are introducing different censorship bills. So, but we do it collectively, like the National Citizens Inquiry in Canada was an example. I mean, when we were shortly before hearings, and then all through the hearings, all the social media platforms, they either deplatformed us, or even if we survived on Twitter, that we're being shadow banned. And it was so clear. And it was actually just individual citizens then pumping it all out to their networks. And you get thousands of people doing that. And all of a sudden, you've created all this momentum. And I think going forward, like, the thing is your viewers have to start taking personal responsibility to making sure everyone they know is getting important information. Like, it's just action. Like, who cares that the mainstream media is not going to share the truth? If enough of us start taking action and making sure that it's out there, the truth is out there, it'll get out there. So it's we can complain all we want, but we're the ones that are responsible.
Right. And I have to tell you, in researching for this, I was collecting examples of censorship and, you know, bad stuff going on. And, you know, the most recent one was communicated this month. So, you know, we can think that the pandemic is over and now we're free. And the fact is, the engine that's driving this is going just as hard as it was before. And more and more things are coming out, which is good, that people are really starting to have the resources through FOIA reports and Senate hearings and things like that. But the assault is continuing at a really rapid pace.
So, Carolyn, tell us about the Supreme Court. What is the Supreme Court going to be asked on Monday? What is the question before them?
The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. So it applies to the government. It doesn't apply to social media platforms. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. And so what was happening is that the federal government was doing through the social media what it was constitutionally not permitted to do itself. And so the question is, when the government goes in and strong arms social media by, for example, threatening to take away their Section 230 shield that provides that they're not responsible for what some errant user of their platform puts on it because they're the publisher. That protects them. They were threatened with having that shield dropped by the people in the government who are trying to get them to censor on the government's behalf. And so really it boils down to, were these activities of the government in holding weekly meetings with Twitter and Facebook and, you know, YouTube and saying, gee, we don't like this post. You ought to do something about it. And then calling the next week and saying, so did you do something about that post? Whether that is doing the government violating the First Amendment, in other words, through a third party, because the government isn't the government's platform. Clearly, if it were the government's platform, it could not do those things. It could not take down what people were saying. But they basically strong-armed the various platforms. And Judge Doughty, bless, I want everyone to pray for Judge Doughty and to thank God that somewhere there was a federal judge who is in Louisiana who has his right mind and understands the Constitution and is willing to rule accordingly. But he basically said, if they've done what the plaintiffs have alleged, that's the worst violation of the First Amendment in U.S. history, is basically what he said. And so this is actually, it is an injunction case, which is heard in equity. It's not, most cases are heard and they're monetary damages in the United States and in the English system. And in equity, you have other types of remedies, and an injunction is an equitable type of case. And they're asking for an injunction. And the first step when you're going into an injunction makes somebody do something or makes them stop doing what they're doing. And so the first step is to get a temporary injunction. And that was what was at stake in the original hearings and in the original decision. And the way the judge makes a decision on a temporary restraining order is because a temporary restraining order is something you want right away, because there's going to be really a lot of damages before you could ever get to the final hearing 2 years hence or whatever. So you ask for a temporary injunction, and the temporary injunction, the judge has to say, look at the evidence that's put forward and say, if this is really true, he's not finding it's true. He's saying, if what they say is true, would I issue the injunction? And so Judge Doughty said, if they really did these things, I would issue a permanent injunction. And so he issued a temporary injunction and on, get this, July 4th. And this is July 4th, 2023. So this is only a little over 6 months ago. And so this all has happened very quickly. And the appeal was within a couple of days to the Fifth Circuit Court. This is federal court. It was in the district court for the Western District of Louisiana, Monroe County, I think. It went to the Fifth Circuit, which is the whole, you know, part of the United States, one of, I want to say 12, I should know that. But anyway, there aren't that many circuits. And that judge overturned it.
So, Carolyn, can I just step in and mention it was the Attorney General of Missouri and Louisiana who brought the case?
That brought the case.
We see the state attorney generals interceding on behalf of the people
of their states. And so they, in order to get standing, they had to show what the damages were to the people of Missouri and the people of Louisiana. And at the same time, or shortly thereafter, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Children's Health Defense and some other plaintiffs filed a very similar case. And so there were two very similar cases in the same district, and they have since been joined. That's not the technical word. I'm not a litigator. They've been, I don't have the word. They've been put together as if they're one case. But the Kennedy case is not before the Supreme Court, but they were allowed to file an amicus brief, which is a brief in support of the other position. But their Judge Doughty, in the meantime, issued a temporary injunction in the Kennedy case. So there are actually two cases that are very similar, and they've named everybody and his brother in the government: Fauci, FBI, the cybersecurity. Something in security administration, which is out of the Homeland Security. And so Fauci, you know, Murthy, Joe Biden, all of those people are named.
I just want to mention it was Merrill Nass who pointed this out. CISA, which is the CISA, had taken the position that our minds are part of the national security infrastructure.
Right.
And they have a right to determine what our minds think.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
Quite extraordinary.
That's quite extreme. So actually, a government agency is taking the position that our minds are part of the national security infrastructure.
Yeah.
Right. And so if law follows culture, then our minds must be culturally tuned to following the law in the way they want to go. It's quite extraordinary.
Right.
Is the March 18th, is that just about the interim injunction?
Well, what happens, though, you understand, the case is over if they win. I mean, because Doughty's already said, would go back down to Doughty, but he's already said what he would rule if they've proved it. And we all interestingly, what's really important is that all of these people have become friends, all these victims of censorship and losing their medical licenses and all of that have been part of a dream team that now share all sorts of information. So Matt Taibbi also has been censored, and he was part of the Twitter files revelations and got together with Elon Musk and went through all the Twitter tweets, I guess, and found out all this information. The people who are litigating in the Missouri v. Biden and the Kennedy case have access to all this information.
So
it's been in the papers. We know they can prove it.
One of the most powerful things. So there was, when Taibbi was writing about the Twitter files, there was congressional testimony. And one of the most powerful videos of 2023 that we had on the Solari report was the congresswoman from South Carolina, Nancy Mace, was vaccine injured. She took, I think, two shots and was vaccine injured. And she describes her injury. And then she describes a tweet that was censored by Twitter that if she'd read it, she might not have taken the vaccination. It warned about the exact damage that she had experienced. And they had censored it. And she sat there and asked the, you know, and basically grilled the executives from Twitter regarding the fact that they had made sure she could not receive the information that would have protected her from being permanently physically damaged by the injection.
And well, that does sound powerful.
It was a remarkable, remarkable moment because she's a very, you know, she's a very intelligent, very effective public speaker. And here she is describing the fact that you can literally, you know, censorship can and does kill. If people do not know that a poison is a poison, and you specifically censor the information that would warn them it's a poison, and then you are poisoned, you can literally poison people with censorship.
Can I also say, I have a, shall we say, close friend of a relative who works in a not-to-be-named public health department for a city. And she does not know any of these things that we talk about the vaccines, you know, among other things. And I dare say if it were on CBS News, she would know about that. And she's in a position of doing something, or her bosses are. There are a lot of people on the ground who are being completely denied the information. And maybe they're, you know, maybe they're aiding and abetting by not looking for it. But if it's staring them in the nose, I dare say a lot of people would be failing to enforce a lot of the mandates and the laws.
Well, I think censorship is their main tool on what's happened. I mean, it truly is amazing that, like in Canada, I imagine it's the same in the United States. There's probably a third of the population that still believes the narrative presented by the mainstream media on pretty well every topic. And, you know, when we get when the people basically take their countries back peacefully, there's going to be some real soul searching. I mean, what is the responsibility of the mainstream media, both, you know, under criminal law and civil law, for what's happened? Because censorship always leads to bad things. And it literally, I think it's fair to say censorship leads to death. In what country in history can we look to where there's been censorship, where it hasn't led to a loss of freedom and then, you know, death of undesirables in the view of the state? I mean, is there a single example? Like, that's why, you know, the Western world has a tradition, and we used to uphold it. It was just guaranteed you went into court on a freedom of expression, you were going to win, and now you're not.
So Carolyn knows this. When I was an investment advisor for 10 years, I found the number one cause of the diminution of family wealth was what I call the great poisoning. People were being poisoned, and that led to extraordinary, you know, burdens and drains on their time and money in a way that dramatically impacted the family wealth. And there's a famous moment in the Vax2 documentary where one of the mothers of a severely autistic child explains that a severely autistic child is going to cost that family $1 to $5 million. And the question is, you know, how much will the state and the educational system pay, and how much will the family have to pay? But the costs are extraordinary. And a lot of those costs happen because people are not aware that the poisoning is happening, and they're not aware of what they need to know to prevent it and to protect their family. And you certainly see that in the case of the COVID pandemic. We just did an interview with Dr. Michael Neils. Are you aware of that interview, Sean?
No.
Okay. So, and he's going to be presenting on Doctors for COVID Ethics tomorrow. So that's one you absolutely If you want to hear it, you might. You can certainly listen to the interview on Solari or the one at Doctors for COVID Ethics tomorrow. Dr. Niels, very impressive scientist and doctor from Germany. He was an Alzheimer's expert before the pandemic started. And as the pandemic started, he said, you know, something's fishy here. And he's done extraordinary research. And what he has been able to prove and conclude is that the spike protein in the COVID injection targets the hippocampus in a way that specifically is designed to reduce cognition.
Mm.
And it's quite extraordinary. And what he concludes is, one, it has to be intentional. This cannot be a coincidence. He thinks it's intentional. And two, what it means is the person whose hippocampus is affected in this way becomes much easier to control and influence. And so, and that's what I saw with what I call the great poisoning. The more toxic people became physically, you know, the more tired they became, the harder it was for them to think. When I was poisoned during litigation and then did a very serious detox. And I have to tell you, after doing that detox and dramatically reducing the heavy metals in my body, it, you know, it was like getting 20 points of IQ back. It was unbelievable. So, you know, I think there is a lot going on that makes it much harder for people to understand what is happening. And that makes it easier to, whether it's the disinformation and propaganda, and I'll just throw out there, I also believe they're using entrainment technology and subliminal programming. So we're watching layers of, you know, disinformation, propaganda, censorship, and then, you know, these various, you know, the add the poisoning and the physical effect of these technologies. And, you know, sometimes I think it's remarkable anybody's standing. Or, you know, what you see is something like the National Commission that you did does a remarkable job of just breaking through the whole trance. It's amazing. You know, the truth really does sell at some point.
Can I? What was interesting? Oh, sorry, Carolyn.
No, I just wanted to go through a list of some of the champions who've been targeted and suffered as a result of trying to stand up and tell us the truth. But you finish your point first, and then I'll go through my list.
Well, just following up on what Carolyn said, and so we're called the National Citizens Inquiry. What was interesting is, like in Canada, we hated each other, like vaccinated and unvaccinated. The media had so created this hatred. I mean, our prime minister said on public TV, you know, how long are we going to tolerate these people, meaning the unvaccinated? And he called us racists and misogynists. This is our, could you imagine your president calling unvaccinated people racists and misogynists?
Yeah, we could imagine our president.
I'm sorry. I guess that was a rhetorical question. And literally, like in the province that I live in, the opposition leader was saying publicly that the army should be going door to door to deal with the unvaccinated people. So that we had all this literal hatred. And at the National Citizens Inquiry, we called vaccinated, we called unvaccinated, people on all sides. And actually just listening to people share their experience was healing. Like, we have to forgive each other. We have to, I mean, we're all in this psyops and layer after layer after layer. I'm sure we're going to discover things we never even thought of that is being used to influence us. But, right. You know, it's all back to the second commandment. We're supposed to love our neighbor like ourselves. And we have an obligation to forgive. And I think part of the problem in both Canada and the United States is they want us divided. They want us hating each other. And God doesn't tolerate that. And we're not being obedient. You know, even the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those. So I think everyone needs to do some, you know, inner searching and get rid of that, because that's part of the conditioning, is that we hate each other and then we're not thinking, we're not open to considering them, you know, in a loving way and working together to solve this, because we all have an interest in maintaining our freedom.
Absolutely. And one wonders, what is it about the people who've broken through that that's different from the rest of the population. And, you know, I dare say we three are among the group, but I wanted to just go through the list. And this is not everybody. This is by no means anybody. But I've got the Canadian truckers. I've got Nigel Farage, who was the first person I knew about. He was a member of parliament in Britain, and he was one of the pro-Brexit people. And he was very vocal about the jab, among many other things. He was debanked. He was the first big debanked person. And Joe Mercola, who has been selling supplements and telling the truth about medicine as well as other things, was debanked by J.P. Morgan Chase. And, you know, the people who work for him and their children were debanked. And then there are a whole bunch of doctors. And the first one on my list is actually Canadian, Dr. Trozzi, who mm-hmm. had a very active account. And I actually attended by Zoom one of his hearings. And it was a travesty. It was just a complete travesty. And he lost his license. But these are the other doctors who are either have lost their license or had their licenses suspended. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who lives in Ohio, where I live. Dr. Denise Sibley from Tennessee, who made it possible for the only place in the country in the United States where you can get over-the-counter ivermectin. She was responsible for that. Dr. Meryl Nass, who now has been unleashed at Children's Health Defense and is fighting the WHO and Valiant, and we need her for more important things than treating individuals. So, and she's a bioweapons expert also. Dr. Paul Thomas, an Oregon pediatrician who was a co-author of a book about the vaccine-friendly plan, which he is now disavowed because he thinks all vaccines are bad and there's no vaccine-friendly plan. And Dr. Ryan Cole, who is a pathologist who has built on the work of Dr. Burkhardt, who died mysteriously last spring for doing analyses of bodily organs and showing the difference between people who'd been vaccinated and people who hadn't. And so Sukrit Bhakti, who was charged in court in Germany for being pro-Nazi, for comparing what's going on right now to the Nazi era crimes. Jay Bhattacharya, who is also a doctor and a PhD, who co-authored the Great Barrington Declaration early on in the pandemic, saying against Max.
Carolyn, can I just share a funny story to interrupt? Because you mentioned Jay Bhattacharya. So, So we had Jay Bhattacharya attend as a witness in Winnipeg, and he's attending virtually. And we've got this huge, you know, kind of movie screen that he's being projected on. Well, and it was one of the only hearings we had the mainstream media. So we have it's CTV or no, it was CBC of Winnipeg. So our Canadian broadcaster is there actually filming what's happening while Jay Bhattacharya is on the screen talking about media, the CBC censoring him in Canada. It was, and they didn't report on that, but it's just, it was funny that the one hearing we have the CBC at, they're there while Jay Bhattacharya is talking about the CBC censoring. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it was just too funny.
That's great. That's great. And he, by the way, also is involved in one of the cases. The two cases, either the Missouri v. Biden or the Kennedy case. He's also involved in that. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he was thrown off of Twitter and probably YouTube also. Donald Trump, the president of the United States, was thrown off of Twitter. C.J. Hopkins, a prominent American playwright and author who lives in Germany, was also brought up on charges similar to Sukrit Bhakti of being pro-Nazi because he used the swastika on the jacket of a book that he came out with. Russell Brand, they demonetized him, and also through the CIA, a CIA-controlled entity, called Code Story, accused him of being a Chinese agent and resurrected things.
Who accused Russell Brand of being a Chinese agent?
something called Code Story. At least that's the way this came up in an interview with Tucker Carlson, which was a great interview, by the way. And, he talks about how he's reformed, and he used to be very promiscuous, and he's changed completely as a human being. But of course, they're holding that against him. And, you know, everybody's got a parking ticket, as Catherine says, you know.
One of the funniest moments was Katie Hopkins did an outstanding, it's about a 5 or 10 minute video where she just talked about, you know, the Russell Brand outing and the Russell Brand parking ticket, and did the most amazing defense of Russell Brand and the whole situation. It was quite funny.
Yep. Now, let me tell you, in this month, Elon Musk tweeted about a former Flemish parliamentarian named Dries Van Langenhove, who has just been sentenced to a year in prison because of his supposedly racist memes that he shared in a private group chat that he was a part of. Bobby Ann Cox brought out a story. We did an interview on Solari Report with her that is going to be released soon. There was a federal fire department of New York promotion ceremony that the governor wasn't invited to, and she's supporting quarantine camps and pursuing Donald Trump on all sorts of charges. And there were people who were attending the ceremony who were yelling Trump, 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 and the fire department of New York was going after those people for yelling Trump, Trump, Trump at this ceremony. The Michigan State Board of Education now is trying to force the registration of people who are doing homeschooling, and a member of the Michigan State Board of Education has warned that he can just see that they're going to use this to go into people's houses without warrants in order to go after parents for teaching things that they don't like. And then there's a recent interview that America Out Loud, Dr. Catherine, tell me what his name is.
Peter Bregan?
Peter Bregan, yes, interviewed the mayor of a small California town who resigned because she would not get the jab and support the mandates. And so she ran for governor, and she said that while she was campaigning for governor, she was cut off of Uber Eats, a local newspaper and radio coverage, Facebook and Instagram while she's running for office. So, you know, this just gives you a flavor for what has been happening over the last 3 or 4 years and is happening as recently as this month.
Well, can I just mention, you know, for a year and a half, approximately, AT&T would not allow Solari's emails to come through. And we used to tell people you can't subscribe to Solari with an AT&T or related domain name, you know, because we can't communicate with you. And we just had Microsoft for a week freeze our emails. We couldn't get, if you got Microsoft, we couldn't get through. And then we started talking about it publicly, and bam, off it came. So,
and that's not even to mention the U.S. Postal Service, Memphis office in particular.
So we won't bore you with all the, you know, our deep state politics tactics that we deal with. But
this is all free speech. This is all because we say things that they don't like.
We assume. So, but there, you know, there are many different layers, both overt and covert, of how you can keep this information from spreading virally. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, one of my favorites that we talked about, money and markets, is every time that things get really tense, you see the deep sea cables cut, and you think, what financial transactions or transparency was working along those cables that they had to cut the cables today? Because it can make, you know, on the price of a stock, it can make an enormous difference. You know, it's a matter of seconds.
There is an enormous amount of money to be made by suppressing speech. And think about how the economy is not running at a profitable rate because of that. I mean, think about all the really bright people who are majoring at universities like Stanford and Harvard in what amounts to censorship. There are people who are getting PhDs in what amounts to censorship, how you censor people. How could those people be used to do productive things? And do you have any idea of the infrastructure of the number of people that are working to put us in digital prison and how that could be used for more productive purposes so that the pie is bigger and we can all share in the pie?
So let's just turn to the perpetrators. Is one of the things we're seeing is the rising of private parties who are financing different groups who are fact checkers. And you know, basically, it reminds me, I don't know if you remember this quote, Sean, of the former Secretary of Treasury told this to a reporter, and presumably it was Karl Rove saying, "We're an empire now, so we create our own reality." But you have these groups that basically throw enormous amounts of money into building an official narrative and proving that anybody who describes a different narrative, you know, does not fact check.
Oh yeah, like the Trusted News Initiative, which is, you know, one of the lawsuits, Carolyn, that you touched on with Children's Health Defense. I mean, how can credible news services band together to basically create a fact-checking department? They're supposed to actually be competing with each other on what the truth is, but, you know, they're banding together. And then it makes it sound like they're being responsible when it's the exact opposite. They know it's for censoring, and that's why it's being set up. But the public is fooled. And, you know, so the question for me is like, how do we get around this? Because we're in an information war where the moneyed interests control the main message. And the reality is no one should be watching TV at all. I mean, I think there's just too much there that they don't even see. Like, the whole thing's become, I think, a psyops.
Yes.
Even things like right down, like everything has. And so we're being conditioned so that our minds are being controlled. And so how do we even get people to understand, like, you got to turn the TV off full stop.
Right.
If you want any chance of being free going forward.
Right.
Yes. And lest we be accused of not saying, who is this? The Trusted News Initiative includes the AP, Reuters, the BBC, the Washington Post, the New York Times. And behind them is some of the online perpetrators who are Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, at least back when and still to some extent. So these are the entities that are getting together, colluding against antitrust laws. Understand, in the United States, you can't have a monopoly. You can't have competitors getting together and deciding to control the market. That's what they do. And it was a genius thing. I don't know whether Bobby Kennedy or who it was who thought that up, but to call this an antitrust case, it absolutely is an antitrust case.
I do want to point out, and I've mentioned this many times, I worked in the Bush administration and had a dreadful experience with the New York Times where the Washington editor behind the back of the reporter was changing the text under her byline to say things that were false. And the print shop in New York warned her, and she was able to go to the New York editor and get it stopped. But the solution was they pulled the story and she resigned and never worked as a reporter again. And the Washington editor stayed, who had essentially broken the law. He had intentionally put things in the article that were false, and he knew it. So that was my first experience. And then I had another experience, and Carolyn was there for that, with the Washington Post, that was just even worse. And that's when, and this was such a blessing, in 1998, I said, I'm never going to spend another hour talking to corporate media again. And it turned out to be a huge lifesaver. We just wasted no time on them and built our networks out without them. And And I think it's one of the reasons that the intelligence agencies spent so much time and money creating the social media, because at some point they knew the corporate media would never do the trick.
Well, they're doing their best. They were, the corporate media. Yeah.
Well, but it's very interesting. During the financial crisis, if you look at all the new media, they had a much bigger market share than the corporate media. I mean, I think right now, I haven't looked at the latest statistics, I think Tucker Carlson's viewership is more than all the corporate news media combined.
Joe Rogan, too. Yeah.
Yeah, Joe Rogan, too. So, you know, so things are bifurcating in very, very interesting ways. So let me just bring up one other topic before we close. What are the strategies? So Sean mentioned turn off your TV. What are the other strategies people can use to get really good intelligence?
Oh, that's a good question because, you know, so for example, I mean, here for people that are subscribing to Solari, you're getting guests on and you're having topics that are truthful. I think it's trial and error in finding those, you know, websites and podcasters and that. And it's, you have to be skeptical about everything. So always never put yourself in a position where you're just willing to default. Like, so step one is we have to become critical thinkers,
right?
And take responsibility for our own mind and always be on guard because it's so subtle. If you know, like, it's funny, like the freedom movement in Canada, I think is going to have to do some purging. Like here we have, you know, where, you know, people will accept, you know, the major parties, you know, are corrupt. If you're not a WEFer, you're not going to become a prime minister, for example. I mean, I think we can accept that there are these networks. And we had the experience during COVID, like every single institution, every college of physicians and surgeons, every college of pharmacy, you know, literally every school board, everyone just all towed this line. I mean, every provincial government, you call them state governments, had pandemic emergency plans in place and a specific department to handle it. Well, not a single one of those departments that were there for that purpose was allowed to take it. Public health had to do it, and they did everything that all the plans said not to do. So how does it become uniform? And yet we don't understand in the freedom movement, surely we have state operatives and moles. And how do we determine those so that, you know, it's watching what people do over a long period of time. Because right. Somebody that's a plant is going to actually be doing freedom stuff to get in a position of leadership. But then within the organizations, they're going to be sabotaging. So usually it's in the form of slowing down, not outright opposition.
Right.
And so if you're in an organization and you're finding you're getting nothing done, you'll start asking, why are we getting nothing or little done? Right. And start watching those. Like I think we're in a big revealing. Like that's, I think we're at a tipping point where the bread is running out, like, because it's the administrative state on every time we turn around, a freedom's being curtailed, like in every area of our life. And it's literally clown world on what we're being told. And people just know, like we have, I mean, it's a spiritual war and the Holy Spirit tells us stuff is, I mean, just rely on your gut for crying out loud.
Right.
So, I mean, but we have to start taking personal responsibility and we have to start speaking out and countering this because
the more who speak, the better.
Well, can I tell a story about one person in Claremont County, Ohio, which is the county to my east, did a what's equivalent to a freedom of information request at the state level. For what the monies were under the COVID money that came out, that was dispersed to the health authorities in Claremont County, and she found out that they'd all been paid off. The members of the Board of Health had taken bonuses in the tens of thousands of dollars for basically promoting the COVID narrative. And so, you know, if one person can do that, and, you know, Children's Health Defense has done the same thing with FOIAs to find out what is happening and then, you know, spreading it. I mean, people seem to be able to spread things virally by putting them up on Twitter. It doesn't take a whole lot. You know, you got good friends. You put it up on Twitter and it can take off. So that's one way to fight back.
One of my favorite things is to use money, because you can use government documents and you can use math. And math is very remarkably peaceful. It's math is just numbers. And it's very hard to describe government evidence or financial information from government documents as hate speech. So,
although they'll try.
who knows? The other thing I wanted to recommend is what I've always found very useful is humor. So Carolyn knows the story. When Kissinger was made the head of the 9/11 commission, the 9/11 activists were trying to stop him, and they started publishing things about how evil and bad Kissinger was. And I said, no, that's just going to affirm the choice. What you want to do is make him out to be a laughingstock. So suddenly they switched tactics and started making jokes about Kissinger and making him out to be a goofball. And suddenly, of course, he got dropped. So humor really works. And it's very difficult if something's funny to say that it's hate speech. So I find humor works. But the one thing I was going to ask you, Sean, because I do think it's spiritual warfare. How about if every time we're commenting in a way that might be threatened as hate speech, we just say, you know, I want to pray for Justin Trudeau because blah, 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 blah. But we just start everything with a prayer request for that person. Can that possibly protect us from it being hate speech?
Well, I don't know, because the other side knows they have to destroy Christianity, because actually that's why the Western world is the freest world, because of the principles found in Christianity, particularly the second commandment. So yeah, it's hard to say, but I mean, I think we need to start praying. I think all of us need to be spending time on our knees that God will reveal truth so that then we can react to truth. You know, you turn the light on in a dark room and you see the obstacles, and all of a sudden they're not a problem, because right. You can walk around them and deal with them. And our problem is we're in the dark.
Yes. I couldn't agree more.
The other thing that we can do is take care of our health, get rid of all the toxins as much as we can, and build our immune systems, and absolutely not accept fear as something that controls us. I can't tell you, we get requests for, you know, questions all the time through Ask Catherine, and there are so many people living in fear, and they're all saying, how can I be safe? And the answer to how can I be safe is that you have a family and a network that you know you will take care of in an emergency, and they will take care of you. And, you know, I always say, I wouldn't mind being a bag lady if all my friends are bag ladies. So if you approach life with that attitude and you absolutely refuse to live in fear, that will help build your immune system and you will be strong enough to fight.
Fear is an interesting thing, because fear is actually, it's addictive. So, you know, people will go to their freedom news sites a couple of times a day. Actually, you know, but they'll never go to the mainstream media because they know it'll create fear. Well, get off your alternate sites for a week. You fast for 3 days, just praying that you won't be fearful. You will be amazed. There's something about that fasting for 3 days that not only resets your body, but you'll feel stronger and understand. I mean, because they're going to throw some curveballs at us real soon, because we're waking up about what happened with COVID. So they've got to distract us. But, you know, we've the advantage now. We've all been scared. Like this COVID thing, I mean, until the truckers started rolling, I mean, I was cowering in my basement in fear, like, you know.
Really? I can't imagine you, Sean, in fear.
Well, I was actually starting a group to do criminal investigations, but, you know, but we were afraid. I mean, it was, it was like literally, Catherine, I think I've told you this, like in two of the last three lectures I've done in the province of Alberta. So, you know, we maybe had about an audience of 900 people around 900 people. I asked, you know, in the middle of the darkness, put up your hand if you honestly believe the army would be going door to door, dragging unvaccinated people out of their homes and forcefully jabbing them. And almost every hand goes up.
Wow.
Now, so do you want to talk level of fear? I believe the army was going to go door to door dragging us out of our homes and jabbing us. That's how dark it was here.
Yeah.
And we had our official opposition leader calling for that.
Yeah.
So the point I'm making, though, is so we've all experienced a level of fear we hadn't before. Well, you know what? We're still here. We've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. We know that it's a physical reaction. Fear is a physical reaction. But if you understand it's a physical reaction, if you understand they're going to make us afraid again, you know, when they tank the economy or whatever, oh, how am I going to feed myself? Well, collectively, we'll figure it out by operating on the second commandment. That's how we'll do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, we'll get through it. And that's what we have to understand is it's a tactic that's used. So, you know, first of all, turn off all your media, even your alternative media. Maybe do it every other week. You'll be surprised how just taking a week off and focusing on your life, start getting involved. If you're actually getting involved in the freedom movement, you're less afraid.
Right. Absolutely. Take action. You know, and that's why on the financial transaction freedom, we try and give lots of different ideas so that everybody does what's comfortable for them.
We also need to remind our young people what is in our Constitution, what our inalienable rights are in the United States. I don't know if you have inalienable rights, but we do. And the more people understand that, the less they will be trampled on. You know, I think there are a lot of people now who do not know what rights we have under the Constitution.
I just bought a new copy of the Constitution for the car because I find myself pulling it out at the road stop and reading another section. Okay, well, Sean, this has been fantastic. In closing, I do want to say it is absolutely essential to a healthy economy that you have free speech. Free speech is what allows intelligence to gather, and it's in the open debate about ideas that you can get open debates about economics, including prices. Markets cannot work without free speech. And of course, you know, part of why the censorship is the desire to rig prices and rig the money. So to me, this is, you know, when we talk about First Amendment cases in the United States, to me, this is part and parcel of financial transaction freedom. And of course, what we know is what these guys want is a total control grid. So these are all different parts of the push for total control. And what's interesting is if you look, we just had the chairman of the Federal Reserve say that we're not remotely close to getting a CBDC. Now, at the same time, we have two Fed banks putting out scopes of works to hire product developers for CBDC. So his definition of remotely close is probably very different than mine. But the reality is, if you look at some of the things they're doing with censorship and some of the things they're doing with, for example, the New York quarantine case, you know, they are coming, or the WHO treaty, they are just trying to get total control, and they don't care what avenue they use to get total control. What they want is total control. And that's what we have to understand. And all these different efforts to get total control, you know, are all integrated into one thing. And that's ultimately what we have to do, is we have to make sure that the world is ultimately not controllable by a small group of people and their AI and software. So any other thoughts before we close? Tell us about the new hearings. We want to know what you do next.
Yeah, so the National Citizens Inquiry, and again, just go to, in Canada, we don't have .com, we have .ca, so just nationalcitizensinquiry.ca. First of all, watch some of our past hearings. Watch the opening statements starting in Toronto. Some of them deal with fear. I give the opening statement starting in Toronto, and some of the messages will give you real hope. But we're having hearings again starting on May 30th, 31st, and 1st in Regina, and that'll all be live streamed. That's still going to be on COVID. We're going to hold further hearings later this year on some other topics, but it'll absolutely blow your mind, and especially watching live.
Okay, give us the URL again.
So it's just nationalcitizensinquiry.ca.
Okay.
But if you Google National Citizens Inquiry, you'll find us.
You'll get it too. Okay.
It's just we have an imposter group trying to pretend us. So they had reserved the .com long ago. And, but they just put up their website, so it won't come up in any searches yet. But it's just, so I now have to stress .ca. And this is just part of the opposition, right? Because in Canada, we're referred to as the second truckers convoy because we just created such a movement and such hope. So I hope your viewers understand we win this, but we win this because we take action.
Yes, absolutely. Everyone listening to this, you know, think about what actions you're comfortable taking, the kind of actions you want to do, but just understand every person takes action. It makes an enormous difference, and it doesn't take a lot of people to really absolutely shift the whole state of play. And I think that's something that you and your colleagues at the National Inquiry have really proven, Sean. So a great and inspirational example. Carolyn, any last thoughts before we close?
Just say a prayer for our Supreme Court justices and yes. for the attorneys who are representing the interests of the First Amendment on Monday.
Yeah, very important. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us on the Salira Report. And this week, go out and do something that makes sure censorship cannot stand. We are a free people and we enjoy free speech.